The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbert presiding, is now in session.
Good morning and welcome to our first oral case for the supposed to be a September term, but we have it in August. That allows for 4 weeks between terms. And the first case is Megan Wheeler, appellant versus Farmers Mutual Insurance Company of Nebraska, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Ronald A. Parsons, Jr., an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Eric, is it Danny?
Junior,
okay. And Mr. Richard Travis, attorney, is also from Sioux Falls. And Mr. Junior, I understand you'll be presenting this morning.
Yes.
Very well. Mr. Parsons, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court and counsel. One of the things that I most love about the law is when a new legal question is presented that you can understand with reference to a defined universe of cases and statutes that, when read together, suggests the appropriate answer. It really is like putting together a puzzle, and the solution is determined by the shape and contours of the final missing piece, or the space that is left for the final missing piece. And this is one of those cases for me. It involves a collision between the legislature's pronouncement of public policy in the laws that it has passed regarding the mandatory nature of uninsured motorist coverage, as set forth in SDCL 59119, and an insurer's policy provision that once again essentially seeks to contravene that particular statute. And after looking at the differences employed by the legislature in the text of the uninsured motorist statute and the underinsured motorist statute, 5811.9.5, and digesting this court's relevant cases regarding those two different statutes, it seems clear to me that this case falls in line with this court's series of decisions in Fenn, Isaac, and Westfall, rather than the deal with uninsured motorist coverage in that statute, rather than this court's parallel line of cases in Cimarron and Nickerson and Poyer.
What do you do then with Glow, which says there's no difference?
Well, Glow was an interesting case. Of course, Glow, the issue did not involve exclusions or policy limitations per se on uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage. Glow was an underinsured motorist coverage case, and there, for purposes of analysis, this court said, well, we treat these interchangeably. And that's what the trial court kind of hooked on, that phrase. And it said the case law we treat interchangeably. And the trial court in its decision said, well, let's look at that sentence. And it kind of glossed over then the differences between the two statutes. But this court has never, ever treated SDCL 5811.9 and 9.5 the same when the text produces a different result. And, of course, this court cannot do that. And that's, I think, is clear if you trace the line of authority. The text controls in this case. Now, the facts, of course...
Which part of the text? The subject and the conditions?
That's part of the text. Of course, in the underinsured statute, the legislature has acknowledged the right of insurance companies to make reasonable limitations, because the mandatory nature of the coverage is conditioned on, it's specifically subject to terms and conditions posed by the insurer. No such language, there's no such wiggle room or flexibility in the uninsured statute. The other thing this court has talked about is that 9.5, the underinsured statute, is a different civil limits statute, and it only applies to uncompensated damages, meaning that if the damages have been compensated from another source, like another insurance policy from a different insurer, then the mandatory nature of underinsurance coverage is not necessarily implicated. No such problem in the uninsured statute, because there the only requirement is that it has to be damages that the insured is legally entitled to recover. So an insured can't recover more than her bodily injuries, under two policies from different insurers. but it can't stack them, as this court has held over and over. And so, and there are some other differences, but I'll hopefully get into those a little bit with the cases. Court knows the facts, so I'll get right into the law. The only argument here is, it's not a stacking case per se, the only argument here is whether this policy exclusion should be enforced. And it's my contention that this policy exclusion is not distinguishable from the one that was declared void in Fenn and in Westfall. It's just a different way to try to limit the mandatory nature of uninsured motorist coverage. Westfall is still the beacon case. This court held in 1979 that an other insurance exclusion was void as a matter of South Dakota public policy and unenforceable to preclude UM coverage required by that statute. This court said we cannot permit an insurer to avoid its statutorily imposed liability by its insertion into the policy of a liability limiting clause, like the one we have here, which restricts the insurer from receiving that coverage for which the premium has been paid. And so the court held that this court could stack uninsured motorist policies because of 5811.9, and that exclusion could not be used to defeat UM coverage. That's still the law of this state. The next big case was Nickerson, but here we're on the underinsured side of the ledger. And so we're dealing with a different statute. And there this court really fleshed out what that statute meant. It talked about that it is a difference of the limits statute. So there can be credits given. And so you can't stack policy upon policy because it only applies to uncompensated damages. And that's the language that this court really focused on in Nickerson. But this court also reaffirmed Westfall in Nickerson and said, hey, this is the underinsured statute. Westfall still applies to the uninsured statute. We get to 2003, and we have the Fenn case. And Fenn is kind of a reiteration of first principles. We're back to uninsured motorist coverage and the mandatory nature of that that doesn't permit these exclusions. And they're also trying to enforce an anti-stacking prohibition as well in Fenn. And this court rejected both. The coverage there was a, or the exclusion that they were attempting to use to try to defeat uninsured coverage there was another other insurance clause, not owned by the name insured, but covered by other insurance. So these exclusions are all different ways just to try to limit the mandatory coverage that the UM statute provides.
Is there a material distinction between the cases where we've looked at stacking and the cases where it's a pure policy exclusion?
Well, there's a difference in the two. I don't think the result is different in this particular case involving different insurers. The difference is that an exclusion just says we're not going to ever provide that coverage, no matter what another policy might or might not do. And stacking takes into account that there may be two sources of insurance.
What I mean is, should we draw a distinction between cases that are stacking cases and those that are exclusion cases?
This court should not, because the legislature already has drawn the line. The legislature has drawn the line between uninsured and underinsured, and then has passed anti-stacking provisions, very specific and broad anti-stacking provisions that left the rule of Westfall intact, as this court has recognized in Fenn and other cases. So if there's a policy choice to be made, that policy choice should be made by the legislature. And this court shouldn't disturb 40 years going on of law where a clear distinction has been made between uninsured and underinsured for very specific reasons, and this court's case is interpreting those. So I don't think that there's a distinction to be made in this case. This case lines right up with Fenn. Fenn, the court said again, to the extent the anti-stacking clause attempts to prohibit the insured from collecting under the policy when other uninsured motorist coverage is available from a different insurer that they paid different premium from, it violates public policy. And that's this case.
And how do we reconcile that with Poirier, where we say that it's not against public policy to have an exclusion on a vehicle that's not insured?
Because Poirier dealt only with the underinsured motorist statute. And it's not against public policy in the underinsured motorist context to do that. Because The court has allowed for these differences of the limit statute. The court has allowed for exceptions and allowed for exclusions. It's subject to the terms and conditions that are reasonable that can be imposed by the insurer upon that policy. So it doesn't violate public policy at all, employer, for an underinsured statute. The clear line is that the legislature has drawn it in the text. That's where the line is.
But is the public policy of the two statutes that much different?
It is.
I mean, it's in both cases. Isn't it intended to make sure that underinsured and uninsured coverage is available?
Well, it's, of course, intended to do that in both cases, but they've done it in different ways and then provided much greater protection in an uninsured motorist context. And that's, I think, because a person who was hit by an uninsured drunk driver, like my client here was, there's not another policy that they're trying to just get a buffer, you know, an add-on against. She didn't get anything from the driver that hit her. An underinsured motorist would have. And so there is a difference. But you know, that's really something that the legislature should debate and decide, and then the governor has a say if you want to change the language, because the language of SDCL 5811.9 doesn't allow for exceptions, and it says you have to provide this coverage. Have to. There is one exception, actually, though. They did consider that there may be one exception, and that's the last sentence of the statute, which says, this coverage, though, the mandatory nature does not apply to governmental vehicles. So they know how to craft an exception in the uninsured motor statute, and they did. And so when they've given an exception and considered it, obviously, and they've in 30 years, they know about Westfall, they know about Fenn, they've added other anti-stacking statutes for other situations. We have to presume that the legislature knew what it was doing. They know how to draft exceptions, and they've decided not to. And this isn't...
in many of our cases that we deal with these, we looked outside courts to see how they've decided. In GLOW, for example, there was a clear majority of jurisdictions that we decided to join. Maybe that's a false comfort, but is there a majority rule on this issue?
I think that the majority rule is that the legislature's pronouncements govern. At one point, you could say that there was a firm majority of courts that voided this exclusion, and you know, I think the count was at least 26 states at one point, and far, far fewer that allowed it expressly. Now, that has diminished, I think, in the past years, but it's interesting if you look as to why it's diminished. It's diminished because insurance companies have gone to the legislatures of those states and provided, had them adopt specific exceptions allowing for this type of exclusion. And that's what you'll see. Minnesota, for example, I think, is a case. Or not Minnesota. That's generally what you'll see. The other interesting thing about our particular statute is, I have to correct an error in our brief. As an alternative measure, I think we propose that a minimum amount of coverage required by the statute is $25,000, which is just the minimum amount that coverage anyone can have pursuant to another statute. When you're looking at what the minimum amount that is required for underinsured motor or uninsured motorist coverage, our statute's a little unique. A lot of state statutes just insert the state minimum coverage into that statute. Our statute says that the minimum amount that has to be provided by an insurer, no exceptions unless it's a government-owned vehicle, is equal to the amount in bodily injury coverage that they have. And so here, Megan Wheelers had $250,000. So it would be equal to that. But then there's a cap in the statute, but it says the maximum that they can be required to provide is $100,000. And then there's an exception to the cap. The exception to the cap is unless additional coverage is requested by the insured. So in this case, the minimum amount under the statute that our client or that the insurer has to provide, we contend, is $250,000 because she requested extra additional coverage, paid for it, $250,000. And that's more than the $100,000 minimum that the statute requires. And she requested it. I mean, that sentence has to be given meaning. It's in the exact same sentence as the $100,000 maximum. So the minimum amount conceivably that, that could be provided under this policy is $100,000, but since she requested more, we contend it's $250,000 under the text of the statute. Now, the trial court's decision, you know, it kind of really doesn't address this situation. And it used that sentence so that they're defined interchangeably. That sentence is causing confusion because it's just not been true when the statutes differ, when the text differs.
You say we maybe overrode a little bit and glow?
I do think so. And it's certainly true if the text matches. But when the text produces a different result, it's just not the case. And so that sentence, I think, set the trial court off on the wrong foot here. And the other thing it did is it made these kind of curious actuarial findings that have no support in the record. It said, you know, what farmers did not do was consider that they would be on the hook for a vehicle that was not on the policy which Megan used for a primary mode of transportation. And they didn't collect a premium for that. Well, there's no support in the record for that at all. Just like there was a question you asked Justice Severson in the Poyer argument. Was there any support for that policy finding? There wasn't there, and there's not here. And I don't think there ever will be, because that's just not the way insurance is determined. I mean, no one looked at this policy and said, well, now, which car is Megan going to be driving in? I mean, that's not the way it's determined. You know, what is our particular risk with other insureds here? There's a flat rate, as you find other decisions, there's a flat rate per state for uninsured motorist coverage. And if they were going to be thinking, well, wait, we're not sure if Megan is driving in another car that's insured by a different insurance company, that would have meant they would have reduced their premiums in that case. They don't know that. That's just not the way it works. If Farmers is not taking into account when they issue their uninsured motorist rate, the fact that in South Dakota, under the rule of Westfall and Fenn, that you can't exclude around uninsured motorist coverage and that you're allowed to stack. If they're not taking that into account, then they're committing actuarial malpractice in this case or in this state. But in any event, there's no support in the record for those findings, and those should not have been relied upon by the trial court.
Mr. Parsons, you know, if the legislature intended more protection under 9 than 9.5 and were to look at it that way, how do we reconcile? We have a number of cases, the Volstead case, the Gibson case, and the State of Davis case, where the court allowed restrictions under 9, under the uninsured provision.
Well, I'm not aware of cases where they've enforced a policy exclusion. And those cases aren't ringing a bell with me, I apologize. But the cases where they've addressed policy exclusions and stacking under the uninsured motorist coverage, they've avoided the exclusions. Isaac, Westfall, Fenn.
In Gibson, though, we upheld a restriction on the resident family member exclusion.
Of a resident family member?
Yes.
I'm not familiar with that case. I have to apologize. But that would seem to directly conflict with Westfall, Fenn, and Isaac. And this court's affirmation of that case, of those cases, in its underinsured motorist coverage cases where it voided policy exclusions.
I guess my point is we haven't taken an absolute position that there are no limitations under 9. I mean, there's a number of cases, a couple involving stacking and two or three involving exclusions where limitations have been approved under 9. And I'm just trying to reconcile that inconsistency.
I think that needs to be reconciled in favor of the legislative text and in favor of this court's, I think, very broad pronouncement in Fenn that said a policy clause that purports to eliminate an insurance company's liability under an uninsured motorist provision violates public policy. This is especially true where, as in this case, the insurance company would completely escape any liability whenever there is any other applicable insurance available, regardless of the amount available or the damages sustained by the insured. That's this case, too. The Wheelers had two policies that covered, paid different premiums, that are permitted to be stacked that provided $100,000 of coverage and $250,000 of coverage, and she needs it all. She needs it all. She lost her scholarship. She's severely injured, and they paid for it. It's a refreshing case because in the uninsured motorist context, you actually get what you pay for. So we ask this court reverse and uphold the rule of Westfall and Fenn.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Okay, Mr. Nur, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. This case raises the issue of whether the owned but not insured exclusion is a valid anti-stacking provision or whether it's against public policy. In DeSmit versus Poirier, the court said it's not against public policy. There's plenty of good policy reasons for the owned but not insured exclusion. The fact that we're dealing with uninsured motorist benefits in this case is of no legal significance. The public policy considerations announced in Poirier are just as important here, and they're equally applicable.
What about the difference in language in the two statutes?
Well, that's a good question, Justice Severson, and it's this. The subject to the terms and conditions caveat in the underinsured motorist benefit statute is just the means by which an exclusion can apply. They're saying subject to terms and conditions, you must provide UIM.
Okay, but that language is not in the uninsured coverage provision, and it was key to the decision in Poirier.
I don't know that it was key to the decision in Poirier. It was key because it provided, again, the basis to say there are exclusions that can apply, but nothing about 5811.9 says that stacking is required in every scenario. And this court has never said that our public policy is to allow stacking in every situation. If you look at SDCL 5811.10, the legislature specifically said you can include additional exclusions as long as they're not inconsistent with Title 58. And so that's the question here. Is the owned but not insured exclusion in violation of Title 58? I agree with Mr. Parsons. We have to look back at, as stated in Hockett, a sometimes confusing patchwork of cases and statutes and interpretations and reinterpretations of those provisions and try to figure out how we're going to Justice Center reconcile all of these cases, and the answer is this. On the whole, all of those cases and statutes and everything that interprets those cases say this: you get what you pay for and nothing more. And that is what Poirier said. You get what you pay for. You didn't insure this vehicle in Poirier, the DeSmit policy, and we're not going to allow you to take that coverage from one vehicle that's insured by the family and apply it to every other vehicle owned by the family. And the Poirier,
you talk about policy. This isn't a family anymore. There's two different, it's a divorced couple.
It's a divorced couple. I would say it's absolutely a family, but the point being that there's two vehicles here, a 2005 Honda Accord and a 1999 GMC Yukon. Both of those vehicles are owned by Maria Wheeler, mom. Both of those cars are owned by Maria. So it's different than Fenn and Westfall on that ground. In Fenn and Westfall, both of the injured parties were injured while occupying a motor vehicle that wasn't owned by them and wasn't insured by them. They were passengers in a vehicle that was unfortunately struck by an uninsured motorist. So after they collected the benefits from the vehicle in which they were occupying, and they came back to their own insurer and said, hey, I'm a named insured. I gave you premiums for uninsured motorist coverage. I want my benefits. And the insurer said, no, we have a provision in your policy that says if you get benefits from someone else, we get the benefit of that. We get to offset what you collected from the vehicle in which you were occupying. And the court said, no, you can't do that. The insurer paid premiums for UM coverage, and you have to pay it. This is a horse of a totally different color. These are two cars owned by one person, and they are attempting to stack the policy benefits of those two cars to create a larger pool of available coverage.
But if that's what the legislature intended, how do we go against that? I mean, I understand your argument that you get what you pay for, but you're contending the Puryear controls here, and the two statutes are difficult for me to reconcile, because the statute 9.5 talks about subject to the terms and conditions of the coverage, which seems to me that the legislature is giving permission to have terms and conditions before you have underinsured. But when you look at 9, it's very broad. It says no policy insuring against loss suffered by any person, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me that the language is far more broad in 9 than it is in 9.5. How do we reconcile that?
I reconcile it this way. Again, nothing about 5811.9 says stacking is always allowed. And this court has never said that it's our public policy that we always allow stacking in every scenario. If you look at the Hockett versus LaPointe case, the court said the terms of the policy and the contract between the insurer and the insured is important. Secondly, you can limit insurance coverage as long as it's reasonable, unambiguous, and comports with South Dakota public policy. So I don't think there's any question that you can limit coverage. It's whether that limitation is in line with South Dakota's public policy. And that's where we get to Puryear, because this court announced that it's our public policy that the owned but not insured exclusion prevents an insured from purchasing one policy for one vehicle and then applying that coverage to all the other vehicles that the individual or the family owns. And the court said that exclusion is not against public policy. So the subject to the terms and conditions, that's just the mechanism for getting that exclusion.
But if that's the mechanism, then the mechanism isn't in 9. The same mechanism isn't there.
Well, if we look at 5811.9.8, our legislature has said you can't stack uninsured motorist benefits from two vehicles in one policy, and that was the Cunningham case. It also said you can't stack uninsured motorist benefits from two vehicles that are insured by the same insurer, even if they're under separate policies. But if you read that statute, the plain reading of that statute is there is a legislative intent that if one person owns two vehicles, we're not going to allow you to stack those uninsured motorist benefits, even if it's issued by under separate policies, and I would argue even if it's issued by separate insurers, because
I don't really see this as a stacking case. I mean, this is an exclusion, a policy exclusion. I know the result ends up to be what some people call stacking, but it's an exclusion in the policy.
And that's right, Justice Inter. It is an exclusion. It says you can't collect uninsured motorist benefits if you own if you are injured by an uninsured motorist while occupying a vehicle that you own that you didn't insure under our policy. But stacking is taking two policies, two vehicles, and creating a bigger pool of coverage. That's what stacking is at a very fundamental level. And that's really what we have here, is we have two policies, one issued by Progressive, one issued by DeSmit, and we're trying to combine those policies together to create a bigger available pool of uninsured motorist coverage for Ms. Wheeler. So agreed that it is a straight-out exclusion, meaning it's not a difference of the limits. It's not an excess. It's not an other insurance exclusion. It is an outright exclusion. And that's the other distinguishing characteristic of this case from Fenn and Westfall. Fenn and Westfall dealt with the other insurance exclusion. They paid premiums for a benefit, and the insurer unilaterally said, well, just because you get coverage from the vehicle in which you are occupying, we're not going to pay our full benefit. And the court said, no, we're not going to allow that. You paid it.
Exactly what's happening here?
No, because a premium, Justice Severson, was never paid for $350,000 worth of coverage.
Well, it was paid for $100,000 and it was paid for $250,000 under different policies.
It was paid under for $250,000 under the Farmers Mutual policy for a 99 GMC Yukon. Farmers Mutual is never aware of the 2005 Accord. It was never given the opportunity to underwrite that risk, and it was never given.
Is that in the record?
That is
the
not in the
underwriting decisions. Is there any evidence of that in the record?
The underwriting facts are not in the record, but what is in the record is the Farmers Mutual policy did insure the 2005 Honda Accord. They were not obviously aware of that vehicle if they didn't insure it, and now we're trying to take those benefits anytime Megan is driving the 2005 Honda Accord and apply it to the Farmers Mutual policy. And what 5811.9.8 says is that's not against public policy. And that's also what the Poirier case says. It's not against public policy to have that very reasonable, clear, and unambiguous exclusion. So, Justice Sinter, we can reconcile all these cases because Fenn and Westfall, the underlying facts are different. They were a passenger in a vehicle, and they were trying to stack their own benefits from their own policy. Here we have two vehicles owned by the same person, and we're trying to expand the pool of coverage. We're not saying that 9.5 and 9 are the same and we always treat them the same. What we're saying is the underlying principles of both UIM and UM are identical. And so this court doesn't need to look any further than Poirier in affirming the lower court's decision. Listen, we've already said, we've said it once, it's not against public policy to have known but not insured exclusion. So it's not against public policy to have it in the context of uninsured motorist benefits. I actually think I've hit all the points that I wanted to raise with the court. Unless there's any further questions, I'm finished.
Is this your first time? Well, then you are not aware of the rule that no one has ever chastised in this court for quitting early.
Okay.
You learned something today. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the insurer has been very forthright and explicit in this case that what they are relying upon in their brief, in their oral argument, in the trial court below is a public policy argument. Public policy, however, is explicitly when the text of a statute controls, that is the legislature's prerogative to set. The insurer does not want to talk about the statutes in this case because the statutes, in this case, the uninsured motor statute requires this coverage. There's a great new book out, treatise by Brian Garner and Justice Scalia called Reading Law, the Interpretation of Legal Texts, and it organizes the judicial canons, which it's wonderful reading. But Chapter 8 deals with something called the omitted case canon. And that's where the court is presented with a situation or a legal question, in this case a hypothetical, where the argument that's being made by the advocate is something that may not have been specifically contemplated by a controlling statute. And so the argument is made, well, we should make an exception to that statute because of this policy situation, because of these unique facts. And the text advises against, or at least the canon says, that the omitted case canon, this facts that may not have been considered by the legislature, what courts should do in that case is resist the temptations to make policy and assume that if that's something, the wisdom of something justifies an exception to the text of a statute passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, that will take care of itself in the democratic process. So my suggestion is that the suggestion that there should be a new exception, including government-owned vehicles, and then two owned but not insured vehicles, they want to add that, they're on the wrong floor of the Capitol, is my respectful suggestion. The cases here are clear. This case is not distinguishable analytically from Fenn. Fenn involved an attempt to stack uninsured motorist coverages by two different insurers supported by different premiums. Exclusion attempted to write around that. And that's exactly what this exclusion is attempting to do, just in a slightly different fashion. Two premiums were paid, and they were paid by two different people. And Megan was not the payee on either. Megan is riding in a car on both. And she's covered under the road Westfall and Fenn for that coverage. Unless the court has further questions, I'm going to take advantage of your caveat, Chief Justice, and ask that you reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Before we recess, the court would note that the 10 o'clock case for oral argument was the Board of Equalization for Butte County versus John Appland, Appalee. And we note the appearance of Mr. Morris for the appellant, who has advised us that Mr. Barker's opposing counsel is hospitalized. And obviously the oral argument cannot then proceed. Mr. Morris, have you had a chance to visit with Mr. Barker? Do you wish to have oral argument at another date, or do you wish to ask this be considered as a non-oral?
I texted Mr. Barker last night, and I expressed to the clerk of the Supreme Court we would like argument in January.
Very well. We will take that request under advisement, obviously. Then we will be in recess till 11 o'clock when the next scheduled case would be Bailey versus Dueling, and that would be argued. For those folks on the internet, there simply won't be a second argument this morning. And Mr. Morris will advise you ultimately of how we determine whether to go ahead with the orals in January or not. We appreciate you coming this morning, even though your opposing counsel was not able to come, and we wish him a speedy recovery. With that, we'll be in recess until 11 o'clock.